This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking about drugs, both legal and illegal, and ethics with David Eisenman. Welcome, David.
Hi there, Steve.
I was thinking how to start this program off, and I was thinking of what drugs I either have used today or will use today. And I started off with an aspirin and for a knee pain and a couple prescription drugs for diabetes, adult onset diabetes. And I think that's all I've used today, but I know by the time I get home, Sunday is kind of the end of the week for me. I'll have a beer or a glass of wine or two, which are legal, but can be dangerous, of course. I won't ask you what drugs you have or have not used today, but let's do talk about...
I wondered whether we would start out asking each other which illegal drugs we'd ever used in our lives. And I'm ready to answer that question. And it wouldn't be zero, by the way. Andrew T. Weil, people see Andrew T. Weil on television, on public television, and he's the great guru doctor with a big beard, tells you how to stay healthful. People don't remember that one of his first books, if not his very first book, was called The Natural Mind, A New Way of Looking at Drugs and the Higher Consciousness. This is the kind of book you'd expect to come out in the 60s, and I do believe it did, if not it was the early 70s. I have a copy. Oh, well, all right, 1972. So he missed the 60s by a little notch. Andy's insight was that every culture known by anthropologists that has discovered a mind-altering drug has made some use of it. We like to daydream. We do dream at night, whether we like to or not. And we like to escape from the absolute alertness of daily life that we're that we have kind of built into us, you know, avoid predators, find food, et cetera. We like to escape, and we do, and there may not be a whole lot wrong with that. In fact, most of creativity comes from flights of imagination. But Weil's insight, I think, at the time, and I've always thought this was a very wise book, was that, unfortunately, the invention of Western science made it possible to concentrate the active ingredients of all sorts of things that were found in nature. So we don't just have a cup of coffee. We take a no-dose pill. Or we can't be bothered just to drink wine. We have to distill fermented spirits and make hard alcohol. And the health issues associated with many things that we now call drugs of one sort or another may come from this insistence on, as it were, bettering nature, doing better than nature does. But we could have a long discussion about drugs today, but I wanted to keep this really, really simple. And the reason we're having this program is that I did publish in the News Gazette back in September an article that should have been entitled, If You Must Use Illegal Drugs, At Least Don't Pay for Them. Now, that was my point. I don't want to debate the health aspects or the moral aspects of the use of mind-altering drugs. I do think, though, that the one thing we all ought to be able to face by now is that purchasing them certainly is an evil. And I've thought this for many years, and it's what I've said to young people when they want to talk about drugs, is for God's sake, don't pay for them. Now, what does this mean? If it means your buddy goes out and buys it, you can smoke it or inject it or whatever. Well, yes, in a way, it does mean that, except that you should be telling your buddy that you don't want him to buy them either. I felt the discipline for years on marijuana users should be that they should grow their own.
Why is the business of drugs so bad?
Well, anybody who's paying any attention knows that whole countries in South America have been totally corrupted by the drug trade. Anybody who isn't brain dead knows that as of last week, half of the national income of the country of Afghanistan, a place we are supposed to be quite concerned about, comes from the poppy industry, from effectively illegal sources for heroin and opium. Along the way, between the corruption politically and the corruption of the farming in these countries is the murderous international trade in drug that has led to a huge war between drug gangs. This year alone in Mexico, the time I wrote in September, more people had died in drug wars in Mexico than died at 9/11, in New York. And now the number is up much higher than that, I see. And for that matter, in our own town, we can see an endless supply of teenage kids dragged off to prison because they are little soldiers in the army of people who deliver drugs to the mostly middle class, mostly white consumers of cocaine, especially. So this program is aimed, I guess, at people who don't think of themselves as criminals, but who in fact are driving the international drug trade by buying drugs.
Now, is part of your concern that some of these drugs should actually be legalized so that this whole illegal system is unnecessary? We've had a guest or two on this program over the last 9 years who said we certainly should marijuana should be made legal, for example, perhaps other drugs.
I don't want to take a position today. I guess I'm neutral on the subject. I could be talked into it in some cases. But I think that today's focus ought to be on ethics. And ethics has to do with what each of us chooses to do as an individual. This is an interesting year. We're watching presidential debates and hearing a national debate about sacrifice. For example, I was shocked that at the presidential debate in which both candidates were asked, what would you ask Americans to give up? In wars in the past, we've given something up. Neither of them had a quick answer. I'd like to ask people to give up their damn drugs. We are causing great trouble in this world. And talk about giving money directly to the terrorists. The cocaine trade, especially not the cocaine trade so much because that's South American, but the heroin trade, the opium trade, without question, has produced tons of money for insurgents of all sorts in the Middle East for at least the last 30 or 40 years and probably a lot longer than that. This town, I live in Champaign-Urbana. I've lived here since 1965. Very many people who think of themselves as law-abiding, middle-class professionals, lawyers, doctors, newspaper editors and reporters, people of that sort, professors, happily use cocaine, and they don't think a thing of it, and they don't care too much how it gets to them. I asked a group of undergraduates recently how long it would take them to get me some marijuana. I said, anybody out there who would have to struggle more than, say, 4 hours to get it? And they all laughed. I then said, how about cocaine? There were only a handful of people in the room who thought it would take them more than a day to get me cocaine if I wanted some. Everyone listening, ask your own teenagers the same questions. How easy would it be for them to get marijuana? I don't think, unless your kids are incredibly sheltered, that you'll get an answer much less than 4 or 5 hours for marijuana. And as for cocaine, well, maybe half of them will claim they don't have any idea how to get it. But if you press them, they'll know how. They may have not actually done it. They may not even know immediately somebody did it. But they know how. They could find out very quickly. We're doing this. We're pumping money into this international trade. And as long as drugs are illegal, I think we all ought to take a pledge not to pay for them. Now, people say, what does that mean? I say, well, okay, steal it. You're being illegal anyway. Why not? Or grow it yourself, or grow your own coca plant, grind the leaves, do it the way the Indians did. Andy Weil points out that the way Indians use cocaine, it takes practically all day to get a little plug that you chew on for a while. And you can't possibly consume too much of it. It's too much work. My wife is from Peru, grew up with coca tea, which is a wonderfully relaxing, calming, fine thing for an upset stomach, for kind of taking the edge off the day. It ought to be legal here. I don't see a whole lot of problem with coca tea.
We're talking with David Eisenman on Keeping the Faith today, and this is a live call-in show. Let me encourage listeners to give us a call. If you'd like to join this conversation, we're happy to have different opinions expressed. 333-9455 is the local number if you're calling from Champaign-Urbana, where the program originates at WILL. That's 333-WILL. If it's a long-distance call, do use our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. So if it's a long-distance call, let us pay the bill, 1-800-222-WILL. And let me remind listeners that this is the time to make pledges to help support this program and many other programs. Keeping the Faith has been on WILL for 9.5 years. And if you'd like to pledge, I know many of our listeners have already pledged because people who listen to this show tend to be very generous and to give early. But if you haven't, write down the computer address. You can go to willpledge.org and pledge online. If you don't have access to a computer and can't use willpledge.org, call in 217-244-9455. So those are the ways to make a contribution to keep this station able to present programs of interest, sometimes controversial. We have a caller already on line four. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, David Eisenman. Yes, line four.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, I know you were saying don't support the illegal drug trade, but from what I am understanding from my children, there's hydroponically grown, which is more local. What do you think of that?
Well, again, I'm not taking a position on the use of drugs. I think you and your children need to talk about that.
I was surprised to hear that right in our area, but they.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't be at all surprised. The New Yorker ran a huge article within the last month and a half about the enormous industry in locally grown marijuana in California. Locally grown, however, out there often means that you go out into a national forest, find a clearing, plant your handful of plants, and pour all sorts of interesting chemicals on them to get them to grow fast and healthily. You spray them. You make sure that no bug gets on them. You also guard them with your gun. It's not exactly benign. The industry out there, it's locally grown, okay. It has elements of violence, nothing like what we see in Mexico and South America. And many of these drugs are eventually delivered to stores that sell drugs, quote, semi-legally to people who have medical marijuana prescriptions. It's a bizarre bit of business and well described in The New Yorker. And some very acid letters to the editor followed the sort of romantic description of this locally grown marijuana. Here in Champaign, well, it's famous. We had, as you know, or you probably know, hemp growing commercially in World War II to make rope to substitute for. So there's naturally growing marijuana in Illinois that in the 60s people were trying to harvest. But we've gone far beyond that. Breeding is wonderful, and we have all kinds of hybrid marijuana plants now. People get seeds from their special sources and grow them in their basement grow light environments or even hydroponically. And to tell you the truth, from an international relations and crime point of view, that's certainly a vast improvement over going out and buying the drug unknown from some kid you know who got it from some other kid who got it from some dealer. That stuff could be laced with strychnine. People could have died between where it was grown and where it was delivered to you in the course of wars between gangs. So it's certainly a nice step up from the behavior we're seeing. And if talking about improvement as opposed to ultimate moral values, I'd have to say locally grown by your friends is certainly a lot better than bought from some stranger.
Well, because we had this discussion, or I should say more of an argument, and I actually had said I thought that the people would be spraying them with things, that it was probably just as dangerous. And, well...
Well, that's right. There are two issues here. One of them is the health of yourself or your child, and the other issue is the social impact of the drug trade. And I think that I was hoping that we could spend most of today on the second one. But as you obviously point out, you can't separate them. And your son or daughter or whoever you're talking to does really need to know the source if they're going to use something of this sort. It's really hard to argue with a kid that there's some vast moral difference between marijuana and hard liquor or even tobacco. There's no question that all of these things represent a health risk, and government regulation is present but obviously wasn't very effective in the case of tobacco. We've discovered that the tobacco companies were lacing ordinary cigarettes with things which were very bad for us.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a wonderfully good moment to educate children to the fact that just because something is illegal and something else is legal doesn't mean that the legal thing is any better necessarily from a personal health or moral point of view. There are people who are exquisitely sensitive to alcohol, and even beer or wine could get them into serious trouble. So we have dangerous things in the world, and the world draws this very big line between the legal and the illegal. From the personal point of view of what's best for yourself, you really have to think this through, make up your mind what your physiology is like, what your ethics are like. But I think the bigger question, the one I wanted to confront today, is what are the spillover effects to everyone else in the world if you make a decision to use drugs? And in the case of illegal drugs, when you buy them, you are unquestionably making the world worse. And that's the point I want young people to confront.
It's illegal, and that's what I say.
Also tell them that people die bringing it to them if they buy it. And I think that ought to get their attention.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Thanks.
Thank you.
Other callers are welcome to join us, 333-9455 in Champaign, elsewhere. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455. And again, if you want to make a contribution to WILL, make a pledge or send a check, put something on your credit card, you may do that online, willpledge.org, or you may call and give the information to someone at 217-244-9455. Well, back to our guest, David Eisenman. David, how did you get interested in this particular aspect of the ethics of drug use?
Well, I've long thought these thoughts, but I was returned to them in a very dramatic way when I did something in August that I'm going to actually recommend to people. You're going to think this is crazy. My neighbor, Mina Coy, who is a very wise woman. Not everybody gets a front page color photo picture on the front of the Daily Illini when he or she retires from the University of Illinois, but Mina Coy did. She was a nurse at McKinley Health Center at the university for years and was the kind of healthcare professional who really got to know her patients. And the result of talking to decades worth of undergraduates made her a wise woman. Well, she said to me this summer, you know, I've heard about this series that was on HBO called The Wire, W-I-R-E. And she said, I have no idea what it's all about, but I keep hearing good things and I'd like to see some. And Mina was waiting for a knee replacement at that time and not very mobile. So I went out and rented from That's Entertainment on campus, our great local source of movies, The Wire. Well, my God, I got hooked on it. It's a five-season series that was on HBO. So I watched 64 hours of television in a two-week period. And there's something to be said for watching an incredibly well-written series, not weekly and with some weeks off the way you do if you watch it as it comes out, but sitting down and treating the whole thing as if it were a sprawling novel. And I have to say, I was completely blown away. This may be the best television I ever watched. Let me tell you about The Wire. The Wire is written by a man in Baltimore who was a police officer for a dozen years and then became a school teacher when he retired for 8 years. He was joined in the effort by a fellow who was on the Baltimore Sun as a newspaper reporter in the crime beat. And they drew in a novelist who also knows Baltimore. And they decided to tell the story of what's happening to their city, starting with the drug trade. They went into the projects, shot in the projects, and showed you black teenagers selling drugs on the street corners and how their network of sales worked back up into the dealers who in turn get the cocaine from mostly Russian and other Eastern Mediterranean, Middle Eastern gangster mafia connections. The first season of the program focused mostly on the black drug dealers in the projects, and they were shot in the projects. The acting is superb, and the people writing this program said our test of whether we were succeeding was whether people living in the conditions we were shooting would say to us, you got it right, or that's not like it is at all. First whole season, we see the actual effect of the drug trade in the underclass, as it were, in a big city. The second season, we move out and look at the source of the drugs coming in through the docks, which in Baltimore no longer have the traffic they once had. We're importing so much from Asia that the real action is on the West Coast. So the dock union guys are losing their jobs. They are trying to find money to pay politicians to put government money into improvements of the docks, things that will keep their jobs. Where do they get the money for that? Well, by winking and not noticing when a container comes in that happens to have contraband in it. They've made a deal with some guys who will just take that one away and it won't go into the records. So we see the corruption of the dock union, the politicians, all by the big dealers making the big money, bringing in the stuff from out of town. The third season gets us into the politicians. We see the corruption of large campaigns, huge donations from people who are a bit shady. Politicians kind of wink, turn the other way. And we also see the laundering of the drug money, which comes back into legitimate things like, guess what, condominiums and real estate bubbles. And by the way, this program all began in the first part of this century, 2001, 2002. So when they were first describing this stuff, they're describing things they actually observed in Baltimore, but they're telling us one of the sources of the real estate bubble that we're currently watching.
All the drug money that needed to be cleaned up.
Sure. That was among the money that has flowed into foolish investments in real estate. The fourth season focused on the schools. How do you teach children how to be citizens and how to be participants in our world when everyone around them is one way or another tied to funny money flowing from drugs or illegal deals of one sort or another? And the fifth season shows the decline and fall of the press. The sad state in which investigative reporting has practically disappeared from our world because newspapers are seen as a source of profits. And as people turn to the internet for their news, newspaper profits are dying.
And TV has a very tough time doing anything really very
– in any depth.
Yeah.
So by the time you're done with 64 hours of The Wire, you have had
– NPR does pretty well.
NPR does very well. I have to say that. But for a real – if you want to do the equivalent of War and Peace, but for our times, you look at The Wire. I am enormously impressed. The Wire comes – the title comes from the fact that wire taps are how the police finally get a hand – instead of just arresting the teenagers on the corner forever, they finally get around to looking for the leaders in this illegal drug industry, and they managed to get them through wiretapping public phones and the phones that the kids are calling to. But over the time that the program was being developed and filmed, of course, drug dealers shifted to cell phones and eventually to throw away cell phones. And we watched the technology of the police try to keep up with the way the drug dealers are escaping them. And you get a nice insight into how the National Security Agency eavesdrops on bin Laden. So there's a lot to learn from this program. But the astounding thing is that there's no moralizing. They just show you what's going on. And after you've seen it, I think the idea of buying drugs for your own personal pleasure ought to taste awfully bad in your mouth. But, you know, I'd like to hear from people out there who would counter my notion that the reason – oh, by the way, speaking of newspapers and reporting, one of the most dramatic moments in the history of our local paper, the News Gazette, was when in about 1988 or so, there was a headline in the paper saying crack cocaine is here in Champaign at 797, some number, you know, North Neal Street. Woo! What a headline. The first crack house in Champaign. And here it is 20 years later, and we shrug. We say, oh, of course. Naturally, there are crack houses. Aren't there everywhere? Well, they weren't here in 1986. How quickly we get used to it.
You've encouraged listeners to call. Let me give the numbers again so that people may do that easily. 333-9455 if it's a local call in the Champaign-Urbana area. If it's long distance, do give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. 855.
Might be fun to hear from people who have seen The Wire and see if they're as enthusiastic about it as I am. It turns out relatively few people watched it. It was a bit demanding. The writers said we weren't writing episodes with their own peaks in them so that each one had a crisis and a resolution. We wrote each season as in a single arc, a single dramatic arc. And it turns out the first three seasons together, in effect, are a very satisfying novel. The resolution of the first three seasons in the last two episodes is the most astonishingly successful resolution that I've seen in any fiction. The last two scenes are not at all just tack-ons. They continue to pick up the threads of topics brought up earlier. But it was an extraordinary bit of television, and I think it's slowly building a bigger audience than it did when it was on the air.
We're talking about an HBO series that was on for 5 years, is now off the air, but is available called The Wire. It's available on DVD, rental. Let's go to a caller on line number four. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with David Eisenman.
David, I came out of that drug culture, and I can tell you that having lived a good life back in the 40s and 50s, that counterculture became very endemic economically for the wrong reason. You know, it was greed and not the true love scene that they were purporting to trying to establish.
It is sad that the commercialization, I mean, once there was money in it, no longer was it just people who had discovered mind-altering drugs sharing them with their friends, was it?
Not at all. And the congeniality, when it was dropped, it became a dirty business and silver-plated guns and all of this sort of thing. In a way, that was a substantial turn in the way that those of us who were in that culture looked at drugs, because we began to understand that the hardness of narcotics was true, was really there. And me, myself, personally, I never indulged in the hard narcotics. And I pity those that did, because for many of them, it was a one-way trip.
You know, Andy Weil in 72 said that cocaine is a particularly benign drug. There's apparently very little physical addiction, but nobody had invented crack cocaine at that point. Apparently, the opposite is true of crack cocaine.
Well, to begin with, I think that a person in the right mind would never put a match to any type of narcotic. So it is... I don't know exactly how to. I've thought about this. I've never put it into words before.
Not even marijuana?
Well, you can have brownies.
Well, no. There's a differentiation between. It's kind of like the gay community. Being gay is a state of mind, but once you cross the line into homosexuality, you are no longer just a gay person. And it's the same thing with the drug culture. If you smoke marijuana or use tetrahydrocannabinol in its synthetic form, you know, you have a mind-altering experience. But once you enter the hard drug culture, it is addictive. And, the whole scene is addictive.
And isn't there a psychological addiction, even if there may not be as much physiological addiction as some other drugs have?
Well, mainly because you have dropped out of the mainstream of society.
I think that's true. Andy Weil pointed out that even the American Indians didn't have packs of cigarettes and smoke one right after the other. The peace pipe, the ceremonial smoking of tobacco was one thing. This idea that, oh, we mass manufacture it, buy it in large quantities and never be without it, utterly changes the effect. And I think that's what you're saying, isn't it? That some of these things started out as social.
Even religious and ritual.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and now we're into a mass media in communications. You know what's going on around the world instantaneously. That didn't even happen 50 years ago. So, yeah, we're a much different people in today's world than we were previously throughout history.
I think you're right.
Appreciate the call. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We'll move on to another caller on line number one. Let's go to line one, a local call. Yes.
Okay, yes. Well, my question is that I just came in later into the show, so I don't know if it has been answered already or not. But and I'd also like to make a counterpoint to my question, which may lead to, you know, another discussion on it. But my question is, wouldn't legalization, though, therehence lower the crime, the amount of violence involved, especially if people are allowed to grow it in their homes or on the land and whatnot? And also, moving to the point, though, is that, but also, that's also another fear of mine, is that if it is legalized, wouldn't corporations like tobacco companies be allowed to get a hold of it, mass produce it, and then also maybe even add addictive qualities to it, more than just the psychological parts of the addiction to marijuana?
All of these are excellent points, and I'm certainly no expert, and I'm in no position to make any comment on them. I've taken a very interesting, simple position, which is as long as marijuana, cocaine, opium, et cetera, are illegal, I think the right thing to do at the ethical level as an individual is, if you must use them, just never buy them. That's my position. Never spend money on drugs. I don't go beyond that. How you actually get them, if you must have them, that's up to you. As I sort of flippantly said in the editorial that I ran in the op-ed piece in the News Gazette, steal them, you know. Grow it yourself. Cook it up. But for God's sake, don't buy it. That we know for a fact destroys lives, other people's lives. Your little pleasure, no, you know, we all know this, but we ignore it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. About halfway through our program with David Eisenman, we're talking about drug use and ethics, and encourage listeners to join the conversation. I'll give the phone numbers again in just a moment. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs that come to you on AM 580 WILL for an hour each week on Sunday nights. If you'd like to support this program and the other kind of programs you get on WILL, now is the time in our fall pledge drive to call and make a contribution. The phone number to make a contribution is 217-244-9455. If you have access to a computer and would like to do it all online, go to willpledge.org. You may use Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express. We're trying to find 300 new friends, and our goal is $200,000. So we need everyone's support. If you like local program, if you like the kind of diversity of programming and views you get on this station, do support us. Only about one person in 10 actually makes a contribution who listens regularly to this, to these programs on WILL AM. So we need more people to respond to the need and be ethical in terms of, hey, I'm getting value from this, I should contribute. So again, the number 217-244-9455 or online willpledge.org. Coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead, next week we'll be talking with Sister Agnes Cunningham about her life as a Catholic theologian. Sister Agnes is well known not only locally but in many places in the world for her thought, and we're eager to have her as our guest. That's October 26, Sunday night, here on WILL AM 580. James Wellman will be our guest by phone from the University of Washington out in Seattle way, November 2nd, right before Election Day. We'll be talking with him about his newest book, Evangelical versus Liberal, looking at various aspects of the Christian spectrum of beliefs and how they influence the electoral process. And our guest on November 9th will be Daniel McCollum, former mayor of Champaign, Illinois, talking with him about his recent book, The Lord Was Not on Trial, looking at church-state separation issues. His family took a very important case all the way to the Supreme Court on church-state separation in relation to religion in the public schools. So should be a fascinating program with talking with Dan McCollum. Support for Keeping the Faith programs for a long time has come from the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois. This week at the Y on Tuesday will be an interesting program at noon, learning about the Japan House here on this campus, and Cynthia Vogel will be the speaker at Know Your University. That brings different aspects of the university to light. Come and have a lunch at the Y Eatery, or bring your lunch, or simply come and hear the lecture and ask questions. That's September 21st. And coming up the following week, October 28th, will be a very interesting program on organ music with a professor from the School of Music, Dana Robinson, talking about teaching students to play the pipe organ, and John Buzard from the Buzard Pipe Organ Company in Champaign will also be there, and Professor Robinson and perhaps some of his students will be playing. It'll start out at the Y and then move just halfway down the block to the St. John the Divine Episcopal Church, and the Buzard Pipe Organ there will be played for people. So that'll be a great opportunity a week from Tuesday. And again, this Tuesday, Cynthia Vogel on the Japan House. Coming up at the Y Friday noon is Wayne Bolton, who will be, he's an ethicist by profession. His PhD was from Duke University, studied with some very important ethicists in his career. And he'll be talking about faith and politics, the 08 election and beyond, from the perspective of a Christian professional ethicist. So that's Wayne Bolton at the Y Friday Forum, which since 1927 has been presenting a different series of speakers on very important issues each Friday noon at the Y. So again, it's free. If you'd like to buy a lunch, you can, or bring a lunch and hear the talk. That's at noon, October 24th. At the University Y, the corner of Wright and Chalmers, very easily accessible by bus. You can get there from all over town. Some people even drive in and park at the edge of town free somewhere and climb on a bus and get easily to campus. But you can also find a parking meter if you bring a few quarters along. So that's at the Y this week. Well, let's get back to our guest for today, David Eisenman. I just remembered there is one other interfaith event coming up that I did want to say a word or two about. The annual Tagore Festival is, including interfaith dialogues, is happening October 25th from 1:30 to 4. There'll be a keynote speech by a professor from Indiana University, and at 2 o'clock there'll be an interfaith dialogue and panel discussion. So if you'd like more information about that, go to Tagore, tagore.business.uiuc.edu. This will be at the Channing Murray Foundation on Oregon Street, the annual Tagore Festival. And you can call Channing Murray if you have more questions about that. So again, that's October 25th.
Steve, well, you asked me why I got back on this subject after many years of, in effect, leaving it alone. And there's another connection to something you know I care about, and listeners to this program know I care about, and that is the condition of prisons in the United States and the sad fact that this country locks up a higher percentage of our population than any other country on earth. Back in 1980, we were in third place behind the former Soviet Union and South Africa. What wonderful company we were in, and now we've risen to the top, as it were. I guess it's bothered me for years that I see white upper middle class professionals buying drugs, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars that they pump into this industry, but I never see them going to prison. The people that go to prison are the unemployed, typically minority teenagers who are drawn into the business at the lowest possible level because it looks glamorous and they see people making money. You know, remember the movie American Gangster came out about a year ago, maybe Denzel Washington, I believe, starred. I happen to like midnight movies in Champaign, and I went to that one the night it came out. The theater had a significant number of people who certainly fit all of the image we have of drug dealers. It was an extremely interesting audience to see that movie with. And we all remember Al Capone, and we know what Hollywood has done with the Prohibition era gangsters, how in a sense they've become heroes and people that we sort of secretly admire at the same time. We know they were bad. The same thing has happened with drugs, and kids get sucked into this and end up in prison. One of the virtues of The Wire is it does not ignore prison conditions. We see some of the characters in this long five-season HBO series. We see them go to prison. We see what happens to them there. We see how the prisons are out of control. But it bothers me that people with money use the drugs, but people without money are the ones that go to prison. We have some famous local cases of people who were out of control for 20 years, spread money around this town, have never once spent more than a week or so in jail, and that was just because they were waiting for trial. They're always seen as sad cases, poor medical problems. We're going to help them with rehab. In the meantime, the teenagers who bring them their drugs go to prison by the dozens. There's something just absolutely wrong about that, which again leads me back to my main point. If you must use drugs, don't pay for them. When you pay for them, you're supporting an absolutely vicious international criminal network that destroys whole countries, lives of people in your own town, and lives of people all over this country.
And you I think accidentally left out the word illegal drugs. If you must use drugs, illegal drugs, you're suggesting people don't pay for them.
I guess that's right. Okay. If you have to use a statin the way I do, I suppose you have to pay something for it.
We're talking with David Eisenman, and listeners are encouraged to call in 333-9455. We'll reach this live program here on WILL if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area. If it's long distance, including if you're listening on the internet, if you're in the continental U.S., you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. And, of course, if you missed part of this program or would like to hear other programs that you may have missed, this or others, many are archived online. You can go to will.illinois.edu. Check on AM and you'll see various programs listed, including Keeping the Faith, and you can then hear at your convenience our very interesting guests that we were fortunate to have on this program.
Let's make it more interesting. In the course of preparing my piece for the News Gazette, I did a draft of it and I took it around to get people's reactions. One of the persons I took it to was a local businessman who knows many other local businessmen and young professionals. And he read it over and said, well, you know, I don't do drugs anymore. I've got children. I've grown up. But he said, back when I was just getting going in this town, there were all kinds of my friends would have at least a couple of ounces of cocaine. He said, I said ounces, not grams, because maybe we'd have a party later in the day and they wanted to be prepared. This would be in their pockets. He said, I remember one time I went to Willard Airport to pick up a shipment with one of my fellows. He was having it flown in. And he said, oh, I got to remember to keep some for Judge so-and-so because he asked me if he could try it sometime. If you think that the drug problem is an underclass problem restricted to the projects, to, you know, the non-white population, the poor people, the people who don't work, you are so wrong. This town, and I think every town in America, and you know, movie actors are famous for going to parties where cocaine is just out there for anyone to snort a line. This shows up in movie after movie. We've gotten so used to this idea, and nobody ever asks, where do those drugs come from? Separately, we read in the paper of, you know, whole countries where judges are shot on the street if they attempt to do anything about the drug lords. We finally put Noriega in prison, but that was after he'd been our tool for a while down in Panama. much of South America, lots of the Middle East, are wastelands for their own populations because of overly rich middle income. John McCain's middle income, but you know what I mean. Americans earning more than $100,000 a year who have $10,000 or $20,000 a year to burn on their recreational drug of choice. But nobody ever asks them whether they will take some responsibility for the horror that they are creating when they have their fun. This, I think, honks me off, and this is why I think it's an ethical problem, and everybody out there listening to this who uses recreational drugs ought to take the pledge today never again to pay for your drugs.
David, let me challenge you a little bit on one of your suggestions. We have problems in the Midwest, I think, particularly with people who go out and steal anhydrous ammonia and do make their own drug rather dangerously. You're surely not encouraging that.
No, I'm not suggesting they steal the raw ingredients, pay for the raw ingredients, steal the completed product. What am I saying? I don't know. I think that people can figure out what I'm saying here. You're absolutely right, though. What are they making? They're making, let's see, what's the name of that stuff? Crystal meth, right? Crystal meth. It's a real problem. Absolutely right. There have been several extremely large concentrations of very dangerous chemical found. A place where people make crystal meth can be so contaminated that you can't use it again.
And meth is such a such an addictive drug, and it's so difficult for people to somehow realize that early on.
Yeah. Everybody thinks he can sample things. I'm not a big fan of the notion that smoking a single marijuana cigarette dooms you to a life of spiraling down into addiction. But we know from the case of alcohol that there are indeed among us people who are exquisitely sensitive to certain chemicals. And there's no surprise that some chemicals, lots and lots of people are exquisitely sensitive to. No child should ever try crystal meth. I think we're pretty clear on that. It looks as if crack cocaine is something that the vast majority of us should never get curious about. I know kids who say, oh, I'm going to smoke a few cigarettes and then show my chain-smoking uncle how easy it is to quit. And paradoxically, it's the kid who gets addicted, not the uncle learns nothing. So, no, the notion that you can experiment safely is obviously one that isn't true. The other side of it, which is that a single experience with tobacco or marijuana may doom you, that also is a bit overblown. But there's no question that there are risks here, and kids have to confront risk in some sort of sane adult way, which is why parents need to talk to their children about these things. But as there's so much myth about what's good or bad about drugs, Andrew Weil punctures the myth that the drug is needed to reach an altered state. I think the most dramatic statement in his book is that he's tried every hallucinatory drug known to man. Well, that was as of 1972. I don't think we can say that Andy Weil has tried crack cocaine or crystal meth. But every naturally existing substance, like coca leaves or opium, he has tried. And he said there was no state he reached with the aid of a drug that he couldn't reach without the aid of a drug through meditation. I think that's a very powerful remark. Drugs facilitate the entry into an altered state of consciousness, but they don't create the altered state of consciousness. We're all very good at that. We fantasize, we daydream, we know how to reach altered states. Drugs make it a little easier, but they're not necessary, nor are they sufficient. And no kid should think that because his life is difficult and he wants to escape it for a bit, that the drug is the only way to do it. Neither should adults fear that drugs somehow or other produce states in kids' minds that they can't reach other ways. They can.
David Eisenman, what do you do about – how do you react, respond to people who from a religious basis feel that – drugs can be so addictive, they can be so dangerous, they can destroy families so viciously that abstinence is really the only really safe course. Muslims, for example, officially teach their followers should not take even alcohol.
Well, and Mormons don't drink coffee.
Of course.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, abstinence is obviously one extreme way to avoid danger. the Shakers gave sex up completely. Sex is obviously an extraordinarily powerful thing. And again, children need to be taught that. It's not just about reproduction, but it triggers all sorts of extraordinarily strong emotions that you may not be ready for. We need to explain to children that life involves risk and that we have to learn how to take sensible risks and be responsible when we have taken a risk and be responsible for having taken it. But we can't lock ourselves up either. Religious ecstasy it was the center and is the center of some religions. The Wesley brothers kind of invented brainwashing. They realized that if you didn't really confront people with the horrors of hell, the possibility of eternal damnation, you couldn't get them out of their drunkenness. Alcohol was a very big problem that they were confronting, poor people who would get the paycheck and drink the whole thing away. And the revivals that we have in America are the remaining remnant of techniques invented by the Wesley brothers for so stirring people up that they would, in effect, flip a switch and be converted. The brainwashers of the communist regimes of the 50s read the Wesley brothers to learn about how you create a situation in which people's brains are so put in turmoil that you can flip them. And our torturers in Guantanamo are following in the same tradition. So strangely enough, if you look carefully at religion, you can find both an abhorrence of extreme emotion and altered states of consciousness, and you can find an embracing of it as an entry into a higher state. So I don't think it's a simple picture. But if your religious tradition is one that shuns a material approach to a spiritual state, then I applaud it. But I have to point out that it requires a kind of a discipline in our consumer economy that very few people have.
We're down to about our last 8 minutes of this program. Let me give the phone numbers once again. 1-800-222-9455 is our toll-free number in Champaign-Urbana. If it's a local call, punch in 333-9455. And let me give perhaps the last plea for donations to WILL with the end of our pledge period here. WillPledge.org online will let you pledge online with Visa, MasterCard, a Discover, and American Express. We're trying to raise $200,000 at this point. It's desperately needed money. The station has had to cut back. We've lost some programs that people have dearly loved. We simply need more financial contributions. I happen to be a volunteer here for this program, but everything in this studio costs money and needs to be maintained. And, of course, salaries need to be paid to the professional staff that makes all this possible. So if you can't give online, do call in 217-244-9455. And I see we have a couple callers wanting to talk with our guest today about drugs and ethics with David Eisenman. Yes, line number one.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm really enjoying this show, so thank you. And my question for the guest is that I understand the economic kind of implications of an underclass in the United States and their relationships to the drug trade globally. And my curiosity is, with the United States keeping drugs illegal, what is their goal? Like, if all of this stuff could be changed just by making drugs legal, right, why would the United States keep them illegal? Like, what do they get out of it? What does the government get out of it?
It's an excellent question, and again, one I'm not equipped to answer, but it is interesting that the minute I make my kind of argument to people who do use drugs, like, you really have to confront the damage that your payments for these drugs create, they immediately come back, well, the government makes me do it by making them illegal. My answer is, from an ethical point of view, you can't just move the damage that your purchases do sideways by making that argument. But they do respond that this is an element of social control. The government loves to keep certain things illegal and arrest lots and lots of people because it pumps money into elements of control, bigger police forces, bigger prisons. And unfortunately, these things, like any other industry, get their own lobby. In California, the largest lobbying group in the California legislature is the Union of Prison Guards. They don't want to see prisons shrink. All the rest of us want to see prisons shrink, but they don't. This thing becomes very entangled, and all I can offer you is the history of prohibition. But the difficulty here is that we've had ordinary alcohol like beer and wine for obviously millennia, and there definitely are problems associated with them, but generally speaking, most people can handle them. I don't think anybody can handle crack cocaine. So somewhere between regulation, think of the FDA model, some drugs are just illegal. We don't let them be sold. Thalidomide injured a lot of babies because we dropped the guard. Now we find that for certain very specific conditions, thalidomide's a great drug. Yeah, this is a difficult problem and not our topic today, but you're right to raise it.
Thank you for the question. Let's go to one more caller. We're in our last couple minutes. Yes, you're on the air. Line number two, yes.
Hi. My question is, you were speaking earlier on how it is Americans, especially, as you said, John McCain's middle-income class, it is their responsibility to not purchase drugs and to help protect the people who are being so badly taken advantage of and hurt due to the, you know, the global drug trade. I agree with that, but I also agree that I think it is our responsibility as Americans to talk to our legislators and talk to our officials to try to change the system so that all the responsibility is not put on the consumer. Because the way the system is structured is forcing the hand, and as long as people are going to be buying drugs, which I think no one can disagree that they will be buying drugs, that something has to change. And I believe we've seen some of that change coming on the local level, even in Urbana. I know that there was some talk of decriminalizing marijuana. I'm not quite sure if that had passed, but how do you feel that will impact the local problems that we see with drug use?
Thank you for the call. 30 seconds, David.
30 seconds. I can't agree with you that there's a great onus on the users of drugs. All of us know somebody who got arrested for marijuana, but it was usually because he had bought in quantity and was selling to his friends. I think my experience in this town is that the vast majority of people who use drugs happily do it and very rarely are caught, and when they are, don't get very serious penalties at all. Ready to say that the awful part of our drug enforcement is the consumer. A college kid who's selling dope to his friends ought to go to prison for 3 years and experience what the black teenagers of our town have been experiencing. So I'm not really terribly sympathetic with the notion that the consumer has been badly treated here.
Our guest on Keeping the Faith this afternoon has been David Eisenman, a local author who published an op-ed piece on drugs and ethics in the local paper recently. Thank you, David, for being our guest today, and thanks to the callers. Next week on Keeping the Faith, I'll be talking with Sister Agnes Cunningham about her life as a Catholic theologian, and on November 2nd, right before Election Day, James Wellman by phone from the University of Washington talking about evangelical versus liberal. It should be a very timely topic right before the election. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. And I want to, again, thank all of our guests and supporters of WILL. Please pledge. Thanks for listening.